Food is fuel for your body, your mind, and definitely your sport. But let's face it, nutrition is confusing, and the expectations on girls and women to be thin and have a six-pack are exhausting. If you've ever been frustrated with your body, confused about nutrition, obsessed with eating healthy, or guilty when you don't, underate, overate, or overtrained, and overwhelmed with all the pressure, then this podcast is for you. Nutrition can be easy. You can take control of it, but it might start with letting go of control by asking for help and making a change. I'm Lindsay Elizabeth Cortez, sports dietitian and owner of Rise Up Nutrition, where I empower female athletes to overcome nutrition concerns and perform at their highest level, to stop being confused by all the mixed or harmful messages, and finally have confidence in your body as a fierce, fit, and fueled female athlete. Hello, listeners and fans. Welcome back. Lindsay Elizabeth Cortez here, your host of the podcast. I'm here with our guest, Keely Henninger. Keely is a professional runner and scientist fighting for athletes to treat their bodies with respect in order to train and race their best. She has competed in the trail running circuit for over 8 years and has represented Team USA. She's been the national 50-mile champion and has won and competed at many prestigious national and international races. Currently, she is co-leading research with Dr. Kelly Pritchett in the ultra trail running space around fueling habits, exercise dependence, and health while training for national and international races. Keely resides in Portland, Oregon, most of the time with her partner, JT, and her pup, Jade, where they live as close to the trails as possible. Keely, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Lindsay. Yeah, I'm really excited to be on, and I love what you're doing with your podcast as well for the space of female athlete nutrition.
Thank you so much. And you're very comfortable with this because you are a co-host of a podcast yourself, the Trail Society. And even that, like I've listened and tuned into that many a times. That's another space where you really felt like in the trail running community, you wanted to talk more and have honest conversations about like female athletes and all they go through with their bodies and training and nutrition included there too. So this is right up your alley.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. It's actually funny how that podcast started. I obviously wanted to do it, but when I reached out to my two co-hosts, they said that they were on board because they had found themselves having these conversations with each other. But before they had those conversations about like nutrition and menstrual cycle and all that stuff, they thought nobody else would talk about it. And they realized like, oh, actually a lot of people want to know this and a lot of people want to talk about it. And so, yeah, it's pretty fun having the podcast to actually address some of those issues.
Yeah. For sure. It's really great. So I love what you guys are doing. And it's nice to kind of have this overlap in this conversation with you today. Yeah. Now, let's just start with trail running being your sport, something you've really excelled in and your passion. And of course, Trail Society, having these conversations around the trail running community for you. How, I know you got into it like around college age, like what was your draw and your passion immediately and how you got into trail running?
Yeah. I mean, I think I was drawn to it initially because of the community. If you've ever been to a trail race, the community is obviously next to none. Everyone is so welcoming and everyone's just out there doing their best, right? Like, regardless if you're the front of the pack or the back of the pack, if there's a really crummy section of trail or you have to cross a river or you have to like walk on a really unsteady bridge, everyone has to do it. And so I think it kind of makes the community a little more tight than other communities. And it's not as much of an emphasis on time and all of that stuff. So I just fell in love with the community initially. But at my core, I loved sports. So I was obviously drawn to it because of the competition as well. And so as I started doing more and more trail running and had like early success, I kind of just continued to get more and more hooked until it kind of ended up being something I was pursuing part-time and then most recently full-time.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. I came from the track and field background and then got into more distance running. And not until I moved to Texas. I've been in Texas for 4 years now. Not until I moved to Texas did I really get into the trail running community a bit more, because prior to that, I lived in Florida. So like what I thought was a trail was not really a trail. And not to say that Florida doesn't have any trail running, but like I just, my versus here in Texas, there's actually some legit, like which I never thought, I don't know if you've done races in Texas, but like I imagine Texas to just be all flat, but like I'm in hill country. Like there's some rolling hills, there's some great races around this area, and it is a different community, maybe not as focused on time, though it's still a competition, but I totally like that
transition was really cool for me too.
Very cool. Yeah, no, I've never been to Texas and I've never been to any of the Texas races, but I've heard great things about both the trails and the trail community down there because there's a ton of really big race directors and like trail circuits down there that hopefully I'll get to come do one day.
Yeah, for sure. Look into it because it's surprising. Like I know it doesn't compare to some of the like mountain races and stuff, but I think you'd be surprised.
Yeah, I know like looking at the finishers of the golden ticket race down there, Bandera, they're always covered in like cuts. Yep. So I think the trails are like pretty rugged as well.
They are. And then we've got the heat too. Mm-hmm. So you got lots of obstacles that you can, work to overcome. But yeah, Bandera is a big one. And the Austin Rattler is another. That one's like a Leadville qualifier that's close by in the area too. So yeah, it's a great community. I love that emphasis on helping each other out and stuff. And so recently, a huge race in the trail running community is Western States, which was just last week. Yeah. And you participated in that. It didn't go exactly how you wanted. And I was wondering if you could fill in our listeners. I know you're sharing that on your own podcast as well, but you did encounter an injury and you had to make the tough decision to pull yourself out of the race. Can you walk us through kind of what happened and what that decision was like for you?
Sure. Yeah. So last weekend was the Western States 100. And I actually am writing a blog on this too for Free Trail. So I can link you to that after the show to add into the show notes as well. But
great.
I'd say like one of the common themes of the race was figuring out what I could control, because going into the race, all the learnings I had taken from last year's race were basically that I didn't control anything that I could control. So I was kind of just fending on my own accord on the like seat of my pants and not really planning for anything. And so this year I was in control, right? So I started the race. The biggest emphasis was on fueling and running true to myself and just staying on top of my own running instead of thinking about, you know, where you are in the field, where are the women that you want to stay with? All of those kind of things can kind of get in the way of running true to yourself. And so, like I said, we were trying to control a lot of things and they were all going really well. So the cooling was working. I was feeling really nice and cool the whole time. The heat wasn't bothersome. I was fueling and hydrating really well. And that was going well. And I was just running and really having so much fun. The beginning of that race is so great because you're running in this beautiful high country. And then you get to start seeing a lot more people as you slowly start descending. You get to see your crew and all these really, really amazing aid stations. And so the energy was really great. However, like maybe around mile 10, I had a little bit of an ankle sprain, which again, I kind of viewed as totally fine. It was just going to make me take the downhills a little slower, which for those of you who don't know, Western States is a good thing because Western States has so much downhill that if you go a little too fast in the beginning, your quads will really not like you by the end. So I just viewed it kind of as a way to keep myself again slower in the beginning so that I didn't torch my quads. But I think just running on that for like 40 miles or so must have made it a little bit weaker. And as I was kind of going down into the second canyon with the kind of around the lead women, I sprained it again super hard where I almost fell over completely. And at first I was like, oh, this is great. Like, it's going to be fine. It's just another sprain. And slowly realized that with every single step, I was super unsteady and just had this jarring shooting pain going up like the medial part of my ankle. So that inner bone, which is super unlikely normally for an ankle sprain. So it just had me really nervous and was also just super painful and made me not be able to run. So I got to that aid station at the bottom of that first canyon and was like, okay, well, maybe I'll be able to run up the hill, and was unable to run uphill either. So basically walked to the next aid station, really accepting my fate as I walked up, just realizing that, you know, this was something I hadn't accounted for. I didn't account for not finishing this race. But yet here I was unable to run at mile 55 after executing every single thing I could control, like 100% to plan. And that was really hard to swallow, to be like, wow, I controlled everything I could. And there was this one thing that, you know, I didn't account for and now I can't control. And I'm going to be faced with this decision that I hadn't even planned for in the beginning. Like not finishing Western States wasn't even something that I put on my list, right? And so, yeah, it was a really, really hard pill to swallow. And so as I went into the aid station, talked with the PT, had them tape it, tried to figure out if I could, you know, jog at all. It was kind of a realization that I just wasn't going to be able to finish because at that point we still had 45 miles of mostly downhill running and I couldn't run a step. So had to make the really hard call there with the help of my crew to pull the plug, which was heartbreaking. And it was crazy how like the community and myself just like commiserated together. Everyone was sad. They understood how sad it could be. And yeah, it was really, really hard.
Yeah, so hard to make that decision. And yet you couldn't run a step. So, you know, it was the only way. But it's really interesting, Keely, that concept of like, you know, when you control for everything and you did, which is great. But I think as athletes, just it's like anything can happen on race day, on game day, whatever it might be. And I'm sure you've experienced this in other races, you know, as well. And in your competitive career, it's like we can do everything and it's still kind of that day, what's going to happen. And especially in this sport of trail running, there's so many, as we mentioned before, kind of obstacles in our way too.
Totally. Yeah. And I think you bring up a really good point because I think I forgot what drew me to the sport in the first place, right? Because this sport is special because it is pretty unpredictable. And so you can go in with this plan to control for all the variables you can control. But the beauty of ultra and trail running is that there's always a dimension of randomness or of unpredictability that you're not going to be able to control. And I think I'd forgotten about that. And so it was a really, really good reminder. And another thing I actually was like thinking about during this whole process of deciding to stop was basically like thinking about suffering, right? Like we also all enter this sport because we love to suffer and we're good at suffering. Yeah. But I do think there's like this level of suffering and there's a level of unnecessary suffering where you're maybe doing more harm than good. And like wearing that badge of suffering honor is not really worth it. And to me, that was where I kind of drew the line was, sure, I could have walked the last 45 miles and finished, but walking 45 miles on a bum ankle would just potentially be unnecessary suffering and set myself up for not being able to run for an extremely long time into the future. And so yeah, it was kind of like, that was a good way to frame it in my mind as well.
This is such an interesting topic. I talk to my friends, colleagues, and my clients about this all the time, that like that badge of suffering honor, where do we draw the line? Mm-hmm. And what I've settled on personally, curious your thoughts about it, is like when it's causing harm, physical harm, long-term harm, mental harm, because there's that suffering there. When we say the badge of suffering honor, it's because you actually enjoy it. You like it. So like there's a bit of that suffering that we kind of like mentally, and maybe that's good. That's motivating for you. And maybe there's a point where pushing your body to the extremes is good for you. It's a great, you know, sport. It's keeping your body healthy and strong, whatever. But when now that suffering means I might be in a boot for the next year of my life or never be able to compete again because I'm doing actual physical harm. Like that's where we have to draw the line.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm on the same page as you. I think whenever that suffering becomes something that is going to impact our long-term health or our long-term happiness and ability to compete in sport, I think that's where we need to draw the line. And I think you'll appreciate this, but I typically relate this unnecessary suffering to fueling and the fueling habits I see in trail running, because I think personally, like we enter the sport because we love suffering. However, a lot of people that I interact with tend to increase their own suffering unnecessarily by, you know, refusing to fuel properly or refusing to take an off day or refusing to train properly or recover, right? Because this sport's already going to be hard enough. Like even if we fuel properly, recover properly, and run properly, it is still insanely hard. And so I just want to change the community from increasing our own suffering unnecessarily so that we can actually, you know, suffer how we're supposed to and actually reach our potential and allow our body to do that kind of suffering and not add all this extra unnecessary suffering in.
Yeah, I totally feel that. And the unnecessary suffering doesn't actually make you a better athlete nor a better person, right? So it's not helping you reach your potential. That's the unnecessary. Exactly. No, I totally get, somebody tagged me in an Instagram post yesterday, and I don't even remember the account. I'd have to go back and look, but it was somebody talking about the long runs and even gave a recommendation of like, do your long run in the morning before eating, meaning recommending not eating. And somebody actually tagged me and was like, this is bad advice. This is unnecessary. And like, you should follow some other nutrition accounts and eat before your run. Like you're, because it's completely it could be bad, but even if it's not bad for you on a personal level for any reason, it's unnecessary.
Totally. Yeah. And I don't want to make it seem like everyone is doing this unnecessary suffering on purpose, right? To your point, there's a lot of false information out there and there's a lot of fad diets and advice given from professionals who maybe aren't licensed to give that advice that results in unnecessary suffering. And so that's kind of, you know, I'm sure it's your goal as well as our goal is to just change the narrative so people understand that maybe that's not true and that's not the case and they don't have to do those things.
Yeah. So let's keep talking about this fueling piece. As you're years into your career as a professional trail runner, did you feel like you always had the fueling down from the beginning or has it been a journey? What's been your journey been with fueling in this sport?
Oh, it's been all over the place, obviously. But I mean, I started off fueling really poorly, which probably wouldn't shock you. But I started off running with a lot of cross-country women and men, and fueling wasn't talked about there, right? Fueling was barely talked about outside of running, let alone during running. It wasn't like people were talking about all the food they ate to recover. So let alone they weren't talking about taking a gel on a run. So, you know, I started in the sport where fueling was not a thing. It was more like how little can you fuel to run and how little can you fuel to lose your period and all these things, you know, result in success, which was all completely false. But that was my initial narrative. But as I got more into trail running and doing, you know, longer distances and continually bonking by, you know, 3/4 to 4/5 of the way through, I realized like, okay, we got to fuel a little bit. And so I slowly started fueling a little bit for these trail runs. But again, like in the beginning, I was running, you know, a 50K or a 50 mile. And I would think that one gel an hour was sufficient. And I think we all know that now that's probably not the case, especially not for someone who's 5'11". And so, you know, going through that, I definitely was the first 3 to 5 years of my career, I was super undernourished. And ultimately that resulted in a huge big bone injury. I broke my pelvis in 2018 after a huge, really successful on paper season, but one where I'd finally like met my maker, right? I reached my breaking point because I just was continuing to run under fueled during the races and then continuing to, you know, eat only what was the minimally necessary food after the races. And that just kind of accumulated into this big break. And so from that break, like I'd say it was again, another couple of years where I was still fighting this, like, okay, how much is enough? How much is too little? How much is too much? Until I finally, maybe a couple of years later, started really figuring it out. And so again, it's not a straightforward journey. It wasn't like, oh, I broke my pelvis and then the next day I started fueling perfectly. It's like a lot of trial and error, and it's a lot of recentering with yourself and saying like, how do I feel right now? And oh, do I feel crummy? How did I fuel the past week? Okay, I started going back to my old ways. That's why I feel crummy. And just continuing to remind yourself that when you do fuel well and you fuel during races and you fuel during your training, you feel way better. You feel better running. You feel better as a human. You feel better at work. Like there's so many things that your body's able to do once your body is fueled. So it was really a big journey. And now I feel like I've gotten to the point where I've gotten good at fueling outside of running, and I've gotten much better at fueling during running, where I kind of just try to hold myself accountable to my crew and to my friends and my family to be like, I'm not going to have fueling be the reason I don't do this race well. Like, that's not going to be my excuse anymore. It's going to be, no, I nailed the fueling. Like, I controlled my fueling. I'm listening to what I'm preaching. I'm doing it, and it is paying off because it helps me run better.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And going back to your experience last week with Western States, it's like nutrition is something that you can control in a good way, because there's always like a little asterisk with that word control. We can control it in a bad way, but that's something that you can control in a good way, but spraining your ankle is not, right? But like, I think showing up as a competitive athlete, knowing like, I've got this, like, I'm not going to let nutrition be a limiting factor. And so that's really good. And I also like something you said, Keely, about starting in your journey, you were doing that minimum amount. And this is where a lot of people go wrong, I think. They're like accepting, okay, I need to fuel, but they're still scared to really fuel. And so I work with a lot of people that are doing the minimum amount, or like, okay, like, there's this guideline, and I'm just going to do a really basic nutrition guideline right now to say like, you should eat 30 grams of carbohydrate 30 minutes before workout. So like, did that, but like, that is such the minimum. right? And I'm not saying that that's wrong, but it's like, it is a personal journey. You got to figure out how you're feeling. How are you performing? How, you know, all that stuff, but like that, or how you even said, like, you were doing one gel an hour. That was a minimum. Like, okay, you did something, but we really need to be willing to be fully fueled and to explore that.
Yeah. And I think that's just shifting the mindset from, oh, I'm overfueling to I'm fueling. Because in our sport, yeah, if you're training intensely and you're racing 50 milers, 100 milers, whatever it may be, there's not really any such thing as overfueling. There's just not. I don't think you can really do that. And so trying to shift that narrative from that, even something that can cross your mind would be helpful. And that definitely helped me because, yeah, if you're thinking of that constantly, then you're gonna underfuel. Yeah. And that's just not good.
The fear of overfueling is what leads people to underfueling.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And it's typically, you know, some sort of background history or some sort of underlying mental thought that is driving that, but it's still not good either way.
No, I agree completely. Now, and part of this mentality that you struggled with in the beginning, like you mentioned, kind of came from training with like some cross country runners and stuff. But in my personal experience, which is nowhere near your personal experience, but the trail running community has a lot more fun with food.
Oh, totally.
Just like the aid stations, the, you know, just everything. I mean, like people are more willing to like eat a burrito while they're running, you know? Can you kind of speak to the differences in the food freedom or like fun foods that you might even see like during an actual race or maybe just in the training as well?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, I do think trail running is a unique sport in that there are a lot more food options and food is praised. And there are things like aid stations that have things that are more fun than gels. But I also think that along my career, I have seen a lot of phenomenal runners come into the sport for a year or two and then kind of have to drop out of the sport because of injuries, malnutrition, all of these things. So I do think it is still pertinent. But to your previous point, because trail running is a sport that highlights these cool foods, I think it is a place where we can almost lead by example, right? Because there are all these foods at all the aid stations, and eating these foods is more fun because they taste way better than just constantly eating gels for 10 to 20 hours. And so I think it's a community where if we can start changing the narrative in this community and kind of like solidifying what people already are doing and making it better, I think that can have trickle down effects into other communities. It's like you solve for one and hopefully that can trickle into other ones and maybe rear its head into the track world or the road running world. And because obviously fueling is necessary in those sports as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that I love sports nutrition products. I do use and recommend gels and chews and stuff like that too. But I think that it's also interesting when we start exploring, like, what are the real food options too? Or just the fun food options. Like, do you want gummy bears instead of a gel? Like, you can do that.
Yeah, totally. You know? Yeah. And I think Nick Tiller, he's a PhD down in California, does a lot around female and ultra running nutrition. He says this really well. He talks about how during an ultra marathon, say it takes you 20 hours, you're going through breakfast, lunch, snack, dinner, snack, and you're expecting your body to run its potential on just straight sugar. But no day in your normal training cycle have you just fueled with sugar, right? So he likes to talk about breaking up the race into like a breakfast zone, a lunch zone, a dinner zone, so that you're fueling like a little more normal, so that your body can be like, okay, this is breakfast. Like I normally get some protein with my breakfast, a little bit of fat with my breakfast, same with lunch, same with dinner. And it almost will let your body work a little bit more like normal because you're not normally just eating sugar all day. At least I'm not. So, you know, he says there is some really good benefits, hopefully, to doing that. And that would be eating things like burritos or like sandwiches or pizza or whatever it is that like, you know, gets you excited during those crazy miles. But yeah, it would be something that's not a gel.
Hey fans, I hope you are enjoying this conversation so far and we'll be back to it in just a moment. But first, I want to pause and let you know that this episode is brought to you by the Female Athlete System of Transformation, aka the Fast Track to overcome disordered eating and use food as fuel to perform at your highest level. The Female Athlete System of Transformation is my unique program and proven systems to guide female athletes to understanding and implementing the proper nutrition for their sport, life, and health. Myself and my team of registered sports dietitians work one-on-one with clients to address their unique needs and counsel them through the nutritional and behavioral changes needed. Many female athletes who resonate with disordered eating, mental guilt around food and body, relative energy deficiency in sport or female athlete triad, amenorrhea, repeat injuries due to negligent nutrition, or frankly, just a lack of knowledge and understanding on their fueling needs, have seen incredible success in the fast track. After years of working as a sports RD, I've compiled the most effective ways for female athletes to learn nutrition, be supported, be challenged, and ultimately find their success with fueling as fast as possible. So don't wait another day. Get to your goals faster by joining the Female Athlete System of Transformation. Look in the show notes or head to the website to book a free call and learn more. Okay, now let's get you back to the conversation. Enjoy.
Yeah, that's cool. So do you have any favorite foods that you fuel with while you're running?
Yeah, I mean, for Western States, my foods of choice were like cheese quesadillas and Pop-Tarts and then a bunch of fruit. The only downside, I love Pop-Tarts in the Pacific Northwest for like top of a mountain snack because it's just sugar. But in the heat, they're too dry. So I learned that one the hard way. But the quesadillas are really good. The fruit always sits well. So like banana, watermelon, cantaloupe, anything that's just like easier to digest and cooler, those hot temps, it works super well. But then yeah, like the quesadilla and the cheese, I really like because it's more savory. And typically all my gels are a lot more sweet. And so having something that's savory is really helpful. And then my other one of choice this year was sweet potato fries. Mm-hmm. And those sat super, super well too, because again, they were more on that savory end. I love them to begin with. And so having those in the middle of the race was never something I didn't want.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I love all of those options. Funny, the Pop-Tart comment, just because I actually bought, it wasn't Pop-Tart brand. I think it was Nature's Path brand. And I was having them pre-run as well. I was like, this is great to have this in the morning before run. But I agree with you. There's always too much of the crust space. It's too dry.
Yep. Yep. I know. They started decrusting it and it still felt a little too dry. But our thought was maybe to like, this is going to sound disgusting and repulsive. So I don't know if it's good. Is to dunk it, like wet it somehow.
Yeah.
Or maybe toast it, and maybe toasting it would get it like release some of that fluid. I don't know. Because yeah, the crust was way too dry. But in general, for when it got into the 80s, 90s, the Pop-Tart in general was just, it was too dry.
That's also what I think is so cool about fueling for the sport, though, is like, even though like you learned the hard way, I think that's so cool to figure out like what products, because it's a digestion thing and an energy thing. What fuel do you need? What will be digesting? Give your body the best fuel. Then it's a preference. Like, what am I going to want to eat? Like, what's going to taste good, sweet, savory? And then it's what practically works. What can we pack? What doesn't melt? What in the environment, like, you know, yeah, it just works and everything. So there's so many cool, difficult things to figure out, but cool things to figure out.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, like last year I took only chocolate gels and realized by mile 15 that they were absolutely disgusting in the heat. So was not feeling those anymore.
Yeah. So many things to mess around with. I was running locally with a girlfriend who shared with me that she actually runs with Hershey's Chocolate Kisses. And I like would have never recommended that because they melt. But she was like, well, in the first few miles, like she loved it. And I was like, I never even thought of that, but it worked for her. Right. So there's so many different things that you can fuel with, and it's just figuring out what works with you. Yeah. So you touched on research a little bit, some research being done and like that a concept of breakfast, lunch, dinner throughout your trail races. And I mean, you yourself are into research. I first kind of wanted to ask you, Keely, just like in your, I don't know if it was your bio or somewhere, like you call yourself an independent scientist or independent researcher. And I was just wanting to know a little bit more about like your professional runner, but just more of that career side of being a researcher. You're doing active research right now that I want to ask you about, but like, what does that from a career standpoint look like for you?
Yeah. So I actually started in research in my undergrad working as a neuroscientist, looking at brain proteins basically, and seeing like the upregulation of certain enzymes and how basically that would impact the channels in the brain. So I started with like mice, but I realized I didn't really like that, but I liked the concept of research. And so when I decided to not pursue medical school right out of undergrad, I actually moved to Colorado to run and worked with Roger Crom there, who is like the founder of modern day biomechanics. Not really, but he's like a legend in the realm of sports biomechanics. And so we did a study actually on the biomechanics of uphill walking and running to look and see, you know, what kind of grade and what kind of pace was actually more favorable or more advantageous for running versus walking, to kind of see like, you know, what's the best way to go uphill. And so from that, I was introduced to biomechanics because in my undergrad, I had only known medicine, and I didn't know there was this like field that kind of merged science and sport. So that was really cool to open my eyes to that. And so after that, I actually moved on to working with Nike. And initially I was a performance engineer. So we were basically validating different algorithms that could predict race times. We were doing GPS validation for different running apps and all that kind of stuff, and kind of just dabbling in everything. But what I'd realized from that is that I missed the human component, because we weren't working with humans quite as much and we weren't working with them in person. You know, it was a lot more algorithm and stuff based. And so from that point on, I actually started working with the research lab initially just as kind of an assistant, looking at the next percent shoe. So the 4% shoe, and looking at the metabolic cost of that. And then I turned full time working with the research lab, kind of starting in product testing kind of. So, you know, in their biomechanics lab, you do a lot of product work. And so initially I was looking at footwear interventions, apparel interventions, and how they impacted the human, which was really, really cool. But slowly began to craft my own path in the lab, where I actually just started to look at female athletes. And so the past couple of years before I left my job there, I was looking at the physiology of females through hormones or performance metrics, as well as biomechanical variables, you know, for females related to running in relation to apparel interventions or footwear interventions. So the last couple of years of my career there, I was doing and leading research in female athlete performance and health, which was really, really cool, and kind of got the wheels spinning in my head to realize that eventually I wanted to go back to school, but I also wanted to pursue running full time. And so this past February, I did a big career shift where I left that job after 8 years and decided to just kind of do research independently while I pursued running full time, and kind of got my ducks in line to go back to medical school so that I can, you know, one day be a female health focused physician. So
yeah.
But yeah, a lot of background in research. And so it's a really fun journey. Yeah. And now it's fun to be able to do projects with passionate researchers who have similar passions and get to pick and choose what kind of studies I want to do.
Yeah. And I love your experience of the different types of research between, you know, biomechanics or algorithms or, you know, footwear and mice, like gives you such a good background. So many people do want to specialize right away, but I think having a diverse background really helps you figure out when you do specialize, like one, your why, and it just brings so much more to the table. I think I listened to one of your Trail Society episodes that talked about male versus female footwear. And that was it was interesting, but it turned out, you can correct me on this if I'm wrong and what I'm remembering, like it was less about male versus female footwear. And I think more about just like body weight.
Yep. Yeah, typically it's just about the mass and how to tune the footwear to compress with a given mass. So obviously if you have a foam with a given PSI and you only weight it with a certain weight, then it won't compress for the lighter weights. And so you have to be able to tune that footwear to compress to the lighter weights so they get the same amount of like energy return if we're talking about something like the Vaporfly Next Percent or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting stuff. So now that you're like, I want to focus more on female athlete health, you are currently conducting research with Dr. Pritchett, correct?
Yep.
Can you tell us a bit? And I think this is like right up both of our alleys with like running and fueling and eating and training. What's kind of the aim of the study? What are you guys investigating?
Yeah. So initially, we wanted to target the entire trail running community, because a lot of studies have looked at just females or just males or just aged 18 to 40 and all of these things. So we decided to do a study initially, a survey-based study, looking at men and women across the ages of 18 to 65. Again, we had to cut it off somewhere. All previous research that has gone above 40 typically cuts at 65. So for now, that was our age range. And looking at males and females, so that we could start to look at their fueling habits in relation to things like energy availability, exercise dependence, and menstrual cycle function, and then kind of like how they view fueling. and how they fuel during races and training. And so our first study got kicked off. We got over 3,500 respondents after doing a big social media kind of purge. And we are so stoked. So I'm currently in the middle of that analysis. And the goal with that is really just to bring to light the fueling practices of trail and ultra runners right now and how they align with current guidelines. And then how can we use that finding to maybe improve current guidelines? Because right now, or improve messaging around current guidelines, because right now, a lot of the nutrition brands in the trail and ultra space have varying guidelines, right? Some say to fuel 20 grams an hour, some say to fuel 100 grams an hour. I don't think people really know. And I think to your point previously, they're going to choose that lower range. If they're given the option to take one gel an hour or four, they're going to choose one because they're like, oh, probably. It says it somewhere. And so we really want to be able to inform those, you know, nutrition brands who are primarily fueling the runners. And then we also just want to get a better picture of how like exercise dependence and energy availability impacts somebody's decision to fuel and vice versa. And so we really just want to get a holistic view of the population, compare male and female, compare across age ranges to be able to then do more in-person or field-based studies with actual athletes where we can provide nutrition interventions and really see how differences in fueling can impact performance metrics and recovery metrics during, you know, multi-day or long endurance events.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the survey is already complete and you're evaluating the results now. And so once you kind of evaluate that, that might set you up for figuring out what's the next step, what's the next thing we want to research, or how, what are we going to do with this information?
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. It's interesting to bring in the idea of highlighting that the nutrition companies are part of this. You know, we talk about like diet culture a lot and what we perceive, but so much of it is, well, what is the company recommending? Like, and a sports nutrition company is promoting fueling. They I'm sure they want to sell their products. So if they started promoting four gels an hour, they would only sell more.
Exactly.
But I think this would be really, this is interesting to just see how their messaging and guidelines is affecting the usage.
Totally. Because if the current guidelines are between, first of all, the range is insane, right? It's like the current guidelines are between 30 grams and 110 grams or something per hour. If that's the current recommended guidelines, however, most brands suggest one gel or two gels an hour, that is severely like on that low end of that guideline.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, we can't judge the people for using those guidelines. And so if we find that most people are fueling with 20 grams an hour, that's not necessarily their fault. That's just what they've been told. So I think it's like a change in narrative and a change in marketing could really, really help that too. And yeah, to your point, it would help the nutrition companies. So
it would only help them. Not that I'm trying to make that happen for them, but yeah, really interesting. I always think about just like, you know, just the people involved, the misinformation, the diets, the mindset of less is better that we need to overcome. But I don't know, you just opened my eyes right now to thinking like sometimes going right to the companies is maybe where it starts. Like instead of all of us doing jumps and hurdles to overcome these mindset barriers, which is great, but like get to the source first. That might make it a lot easier.
Yeah, it's like a lot of women who are advocates for fueling in the space have a lot of followers, right? And a lot of followers do take advice from athletes, but who gets more like viewership? It's the nutrition companies. Those are the women, they buy a gel, they read the back, it says eat one an hour, they're going to eat one an hour. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think we can start there.
Interesting. Yeah. This might be premature or you might not be allowed to, I don't know, but as you're evaluating the data, anything come up that you can talk about that's been interesting to you or can we not say yet or we just don't know yet?
Yeah, we're not talking about it quite yet, but we can have another pod, you know, in a couple months and we can go through the data for sure. And that will be really fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I think another interesting thing that I'd be interested to see, as you mentioned, is like the energy availability. Like do people with lower energy availability, how are you measuring that, by the way? Because it's a survey.
Mm-hmm. It's a LEAF-Q. So low energy availability, female questionnaire. So it looks at things like their menstrual cycle function right now, their previous injuries, all that kind of stuff. And basically you tally all of the questions they answer and you give them a score, and a certain score means they're at high risk, a certain score means they're at moderate risk, and a certain score means they're at low risk.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we still need more proof for female athletes to just kind of like connect the dots that low energy intake is strongly correlated to high injuries or menstrual dysfunction and worsening performance. And I will say probably that worsening performance is the biggest marker that we need more proof for. And it's there. We have proof. We have research, but it's still, there's still a mindset of, okay, I know losing my period is bad, but I'm willing to do it if I can perform better. Or I know I could get an injury, but I don't have one yet, so I'm willing to push that. You know, the temptation is still very, very strong for a lot of female athletes to do whatever it takes, do that unnecessary suffering that we were talking about before, if it means they'll get the glory of winning.
Totally.
Right. And so I feel like I'm showing my clients all the time, like, well, there's this study, well, there's this example and this example, but like, we still need more to show the population that like the less energy we take in, the more we underfuel, the more we're on the minimum. This is the detriments performance wise. So I'm, you know, you can't manipulate the data. So I will see what you find, but I'm excited to see that because I know that that's the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's kind of our goal with this initial study is to be able to take the data and then create some sort of intervention study in person where we actually are intervening with their fueling and then measuring performance metrics to then be able to be like, hey, actually, when you do increase your fueling, X, Y, and Z happens. And I feel like that could be really tangible because to your point, when you're talking to a 12-year-old standout phenom runner, right? If you tell her that underfueling now is going to lead to early onset osteoporosis, osteopenia. She doesn't know what that means, right? Like, so if we can tell her that doing this now actually might just make you a worse runner, that will resonate. So,
yeah. I wish so often just within my own business, like I wish there was a way, and there maybe is, but like I see it in my individual clients that they are improving their performance as they feel better and as they recover and as they heal. There's always sometimes this messy middle ground though, especially if there is an injury involved, like they come to me because they already have a stress fracture. They come to me maybe because performance isn't going well. So there's sometimes this messy middle ground, but like sometimes it's immediate and within like a couple weeks or 3 months. Like I started working with somebody, I caught up with her yesterday and she's like, I'm feeling great in all my workouts. I'm like, awesome. It's literally only been 3 weeks. So that's amazing. And then I have clients that I've worked with for a year and we're seeing that full circle of like, you recovered from injury, you're fueling better, you made it to the next level, you just landed a scholarship, you just won this huge like national level race. And it's, I can see that in my clients. And I wish I could like pull it all together in a research format.
Totally. But, and you know, what's interesting about that is that normally people think to get better, they have to feel crappy the whole time, right? It's again, this unnecessary suffering. They're like, well, why do I feel good? So I've had a couple people like on this cyclical journey, right? Where some people take into the fueling right away. And then all of a sudden performance increases, they stay on that track and performance continues to increase. Some people though, jump on this journey, start fueling more, maybe recovering more, running way better. And they're like, why do I feel good? I'm going to actually start overdoing it again because I'm supposed to suffer. And then they start this spiral again, and then you have to bring them back up. And it's this cycle that you have to remind people, like, we don't have to feel crappy all the time. There's going to be runs where you have to suffer for sure. We're running a sport that is very hard, but that's not every single run. You're allowed to finish a workout and feel like you just crushed that workout. That is totally allowed.
Mm-hmm. And it feels good when you accept that too. Like when you crush a workout and feel good and feel like energized and enthusiastic about it, when training brings more energy to your life than taking it away.
Yep.
It feels so good when you get to that point. Nice little quote here is like, I know you can run through the pain, but I'd rather you run without the pain. Like it's running either way, right?
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Like, of course you can run through the pain, but you can also run pain-free. It's just, and it's more glorious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Well, this has been an awesome conversation, Keely. And I'm so glad that you are leading this industry with the research to back up. Like we need the research on this stuff to continue to help the running community, the athletic community, the female athlete community, and then you're also leading by example in your own professional running career. So it's really great to see and to hear.
Yeah, thanks. That's definitely a goal. And same to you. Thanks for putting out this podcast and talking about things that everybody needs to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I always finish every episode with a few just fun questions. They've all been fun so far, but different fun questions. Keely, if there was one food you could eat every single day for the rest of your life and never get sick of it, what would it be?
Oh, that's really hard. I'd say bananas and almond butter. So it's two, but they go together. So it counts as one.
Yeah. It counts as one for sure. I like that one. Yeah. And so do you prefer almond butter over peanut butter?
Yeah, I do. But it's because my boyfriend has a really bougie almond butter grinder, I think. So I feel like I have more access to it than if I had to buy a really expensive jar every day. Then I might choose peanut butter. Yeah.
Very cool. So seems like an obvious one, but you never know. What is your favorite sport to participate in?
I mean, definitely trail running for sure. But I would say one sport that I miss playing that I don't let myself play anymore is soccer for sure. It was probably my most fun, most like carefree sport because I didn't put that much pressure into it and it was so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Now, how about as a spectator? What's your favorite sport to watch and be a fan of?
I think my favorite sport to watch would be basketball.
Oh, what's your team?
I don't really have a team. I just love watching March Madness. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up playing basketball. Basketball was like the biggest sport in my family. So I think it still is like my favorite sport to watch. It's so fast paced.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I think as a spectator, I like those fast paced sports too. Yeah. Very cool. Okay. And then last question, if there is a female athlete out there that you would like to give a shout out to for being what I call fierce, fit, and fuel, just being a role model to other female athletes, whether in your personal life or otherwise, who would that be and why?
Oh my goodness. Just one female athlete.
I know. I know.
Well, I mean, I want to give a shout out to, I would say this is going to be a little biased, but I'm going to give a shout out to Hillary Allen, who's my co-host on my podcast, just because she's been so open with her injury journey from when she fell off a really dangerous cliff at one of her trail races and was kind of broken for a long time. She wrote this amazing book and just is super raw and open with it and kind of is now emphasizing that like, even though something might seem insurmountable at the time, like you can continue on and you might still have your best days ahead of you. So if something feels like really insurmountable right now, that might not be your lowest. You might have like the better days ahead, which is really, really cool and really good way to think about a setback.
That's great. So Hillary Allen, what is her book titled?
The book by Hillary Allen is called Out and Back, Her Survival Against All Odds.
Awesome. I will have to look into that one. Well, so shout out to Hillary Allen and her book. And just thank you so much, Keely. This has been an awesome conversation. So we appreciate you. And yeah, maybe we'll have you back on once you evaluate that data. We'd love to review it and give our listeners like the science behind all of this. Talking is great, but science is even better.
Yep. Science is definitely my favorite thing. So if that was a sport, I would have chosen that one. That was my favorite. But
yeah.
But yeah, thanks so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
I really hope you enjoyed that episode and thanks for listening. But before I let you go, I have free resources that you can have access to right away, right now, so that you can start fueling your body as a fierce, fit, and fueled female athlete. First, I have your Red S recovery race. If you've ever wondered if you might be struggling with Red S, curious to learn more, or know you have Red S and are looking to recover fast, then you can head to www.riseupnutritionrun.com/redS and download the Red S Recovery Race. See how you place and figure out the next steps to recovery. Plus, while there, I have a few other great resources for you, including 3 nutrition secrets that every elite athlete swears by and access to our private Facebook community, Female Athlete Nutrition. So again, to gain access to all of this, head to riseupnutritionrun.com/redS. That's /REDS. And you can gain access and get the help you need fast. Too many girls and women and female athletes struggle with nutrition, but you don't have to any longer. Become fierce, fit, and fueled. Links in the show notes, and I'll see you next time.